I mean, what's Pro Football Focus doing? Last week they had Brady. This week they got Brady.
We're doing it. We're literally doing it differently from everybody else.
As a matter of fact, moving forward from this point on, I will not make reference to PFL.
Ready to get into it?
Yeah, yeah.
All right. We're going team by team. I will be very careful about slinging stuff. Am I going to get sued?
Is that legal on this?
I like football. I like football season and all the things that go with it.
Welcome into the PFF NFL podcast. Steve Palazzolo, Sam Monson. We're here for our Wednesday show. A little dim in the studio here. Are we missing a light somewhere? No, it looks good. It looks good.
It's pretty blinding.
It's our midweek show. My favorite show of the week, Sam, because we get to hear everybody's emails.
I've had to rewrite the my PFF contract to limit the number of lights that are allowed to shine directly
on that's
my
what it is.
Bald ass head. That's the problem.
Great. Great. Might hide my grades too. So.
Yeah.
Hey, what are we doing today?
Lots of exciting things, Steve. We got a charity update because there's actually movement on the baseball front. We have a bunch of emails from the mailbag, one of which you're going to need to read because there's a bunch of y'alls in there, and we've established that I don't say that word anymore.
You don't say that.
And then we have a special guest previewing Thursday Night Football. The great Mike Ryan Ruiz of the Lebatard Show is coming on to help us talk about the Dolphins, the Heat in Miami, and that's the weather rather than the basketball team. Though they got a reference as well. And the matchup with the Bengals. So, action-packed show, Steve.
Action-packed. I love it. So, yeah, Dolphins-Bengals preview coming at the very end here. But first, we all know that you guys all raised the money. We appreciate it. To see if Sam could throw 60 miles an hour.
Mm-hmm.
And you've been practicing.
No, I wouldn't go that far. I went to a park with my neighbor with a radar gun just to find out where we were, you know? Just a level set. Because I've been pretty confident the whole way, and you've been equally confident that my confidence is misplaced. So I was like, well, I need to know. I need to see a number and find out what any of this is, because I have no clue. So we went out there. Now, the first thing I would say is that after, a while of pitching, quote unquote, there's a lot of parts of your body start to hurt. And weird parts, nothing to do with your arm.
Yeah.
Like, I could feel it in the elbow a bit later, but like my hip had thrown out like I was a 90-year-old man. A couple of days later, like every muscle in my core was like, what just happened to me?
Yeah. I spent hours working on front hip, internal rotation, thoracic mobility, and things like that just to make sure I could throw the ball hard and stay healthy. You think you just roll out there and not feel like you were just in a car crash the day before? Of course.
Yeah.
That's what happens when you pitch. Your whole body's into it and it hurts.
So the upshot, the bottom line takeaway from all this is that it is firmly positioned on a knife edge heading into the real thing whenever Solfaro finds us a stadium or a mound, 60 feet in a mound.
Don't lose the drama.
I've said whenever, if ever, I don't care. We need a new place to do it, and he's working on it. That's all I'm saying. Anyway, the point being, the bottom line here, good news for you, 60 did not appear on the radar gun.
Yeah.
Good news for me, we got very close. Very close. And there's a lot of mileage. There's a lot of low-hanging fruit in terms of absolute garbage technique. For example, there's something wrong with my grip of throwing a ball, and every ball comes out like a curveball.
Yeah.
No matter what I do to it, every ball comes out like a curveball. So that's not good.
Like my 5-year-old.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it comes out with pace as a curveball, just less pace than I need it to. And that feels like something I can fix between now and the thing.
Yeah. I mean, I could fix it for you, and it'd probably be worth 4 miles an hour off the bat. So.
That's unfortunate, because you're the one person that I think is unlikely to do that.
Probably don't want to help fix it.
Yeah. The other thing is, I wasn't throwing from a mound, which you seem to think is worth miles per hour as well.
It usually does help.
Now, the problem is we might not be able to pitch from a mound if we get somebody's stadium.
If you were pitching, the mound and the incline should help.
Yeah.
If you're like crow hopping,
I stuck to the rules. No crow hopping was involved. Just a single step and launch.
I mean, I was confident enough I'd let you crow hop, but it sounds like that might.
That was specifically against the rules as determined by Matt Money Smith, the Chargers play-by-play guy.
Oh, that's right.
Which is where this sort of spawned from. So
we should get Money on the show too.
Oh, well, if we hit 60, I will absolutely be hitting Money up and saying, sir, donate to that GoFundMe because I have proved you wrong.
So here's what we're going to do. If you hit 60, we're going to go to all the doubters, haters.
I will be individually.
But we'll have them on the show. We'll just call them up on the show. Say, I did it. You do like a victory. You get 30 seconds and then we hang up on them and then go to the next person.
No. You I did it. You get the victory lap. And then how much will you be donating to the GoFundMe?
How much will you be donating? Yeah. And then go to the next person. So we can have a victory lap.
Anyway, so I'm sticking to the rules with the no crow hop thing. Now, if we get to the day and everything is topped out at 58, 59, I might crow hop at the end just to try and hit the 60. And we'll then have to argue about whether that counts or not. But anyway, the point being, we're on a knife edge. We're very close, and there's some fixable things in the technique.
Not
that I know how to fix them, but there's some fixable things.
I would say Google it, but man, there's some trash throwing coaches out there on YouTube.
It also feels like it's like a golf swing. You know what I mean? It's like when you spend the entire time thinking about the 17 different things in your swing that need to be right, you're screwed. It's too much thinking involved.
You need cues.
I needed one thing maybe. Otherwise,
I think the next thing. What if I teach you after the fact and get you to 70? You know, like what if I could get you to 70?
That would annoy me a lot, I think, if I hit 58, you know?
And then I work with you to get
to... Have to lose the bet, yeah. And then in like the space of 20 minutes, you get me up to 70? That would upset me I think.
Be pretty fun.
Yeah.
Stay tuned for that. Also, don't forget, PFF has an app. I've already seen a lot of the new cool stuff that's coming soon. So get there right now. Download the app. We got industry-leading fantasy football advice, our exclusive betting dashboards, the latest premium football analysis, especially from Sam. Just read all of Sam's articles, share them, and tell your friends. So grab the PFF app right now. It continues to get better every single day, literally every single day. PFF app. Go check it out in the app store. All right, Sam, it's email time. And how do you get these emails sent to us? Well, you email at nflpodcast@pff.com.
You do.
Find us on Twitter at @PFFNFLPod and then at @PFFNFLPodcast on the TikTok.
Yeah.
So let's start with the emails.
Okay, so you need to read the first one because it's come in from a man that uses the word y'all.
This is the Mountain Time Man one?
Well, click on the link. You see, I put links into the document that you don't use properly.
The Hall of Fame pushback one.
Yeah.
That's the one. The one labeled Hall of Fame pushback.
We went through all these first-year eligible Hall of Fame guys, and we gave a yay or nay, and somebody has given us pushback. So a guy called Brandon Stringer, his email is there. I now need you to read it.
It's about guards.
It's about one specific guard more than guards. Okay.
From Brandon, at least at some point. Did you cut this yet?
I apparently have lost a chunk of his email. Hang tight.
Beautiful.
What was the guy's name? Brandon something.
Hey, while you're waiting, let me tell you about Underdog Fantasy. How's that? We'll get you guys into the top of the show before we talk about
it. So it requires the title of the email is the problem. So the title of the email is Jerry is officially a Hall of Famer. Jerry Evans, the New Orleans Saints guard. Then, on you go.
Oh, at least at some point.
There you go. See?
All right. Already assuming Quentin Nelson will make it in 4 years. Zach Martin is still going, but didn't overlap much. Evan Mathis isn't close. Jari's got as many Pro Bowls as Mathis had years as starter. And yes, Pro Bowls are a fine proxy.
Mm.
Well, maybe. They're all conference awards without garbage time. The garbage games come at the end of the season with seeding essentially locked up. Mankins doesn't have the 09-12 peak that Jari had. Jari's got twice the first team All-Pros. That's four. Twice as many as Yanda, who also should be in but isn't eligible yet. And every four-time All-Pro first-teamer is or will be in. Y'all admit Martin will be. They're the only two not in. Should definitely look at the guards that are in. Then y'all will realize there aren't many in either. Despite not being a rotating position and playing every snap, unlike special teams, really don't need the 28th to 30th wide receivers all-time right now in. It's a good question. About that, you know, the guards who play every down versus the flashy wide receivers. There's three of them on the field at any given time, and they can make plays. They're overrepresented receivers. That's what Brandon's saying here. Along with positions like QB, but that's a different discussion. Jari, top nine all-time at guard. Ironically, that's where he is on Pro Football References Hall of Fame as well. Third in their AV metric, and he says, yes, metrics outside of PFF count. Yes, metrics outside of PFF do count.
Mm-hmm.
However, if you would like to present to me a good offensive line metric, feel free. Because I would say AV from Pro Football Reference is not, because it's really just dependent on did you play football and were you on a good offense? Mm-hmm. That's how they judge guards.
There's more to this email, by the way.
But and Carl Nix had half of Jari's career, literally six first 12 seasons, and that definitely matters. Jari had as many Pro Bowls as Nix had seasons total. But let's assume all of those mentioned are better and worthy and not true. There's six guards in the 16 PFF years. Should be more, since you're definitely projecting with Nelson and Slightly Martin. There's 64 starters a year, meanwhile, there's Breeze, Brady, Rogers, Manning, Russ, the tail end of Favre, and probably assuming Mahomes, since Nelson is being projected too, and there's only 32 of those spots. What's he trying to say? There's as many... If you're being as fair to guards as you're being...
Yeah, I mean, so there's a bunch of points in here, some of which are valid, some of which I think are not.
He's ranted on guards.
Yes.
He basically finishes by saying, put some respect on the 2010s all-decade team member.
Yeah.
Maybe we should.
We'll get to that. It is a fair point to say that we should be trying to get guards in versus wide receivers where there's already a million and, you know, blah, blah, blah. That's a fair point and a reasonable one. That being said, I don't think we're down to, you know, the 30th best wide receivers of all time. I think we're already, like, it's only a couple of years since we were able to get Chris Carter in, who was arguably the second best receiver of all time when he retired. You know what I mean? Like, the standard is still pretty high for receivers, even if the waters have been muddied a bit by some of the guys that have gone in. The big point, though, is, like, Pro Bowls is a joke. Pro Bowl is a terrible measure of everything. It's a farce. It's ridiculous, and it's gotten worse since it started, because now there's a fan vote element, and the whole thing is a mess. So you can't possibly use Pro Bowls as a reasonable measure of whether an offensive lineman deserves to be in or not. Now,
there was a point, I forget the point I wanted to make, where I said I would use Pro Bowls. I don't have it offhand, though.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Good point. Thanks. Well made. Thanks. You are going to be doing a little piece of public service broadcasting about the great Willie
Anderson. Propaganda. It's propaganda.
I was going to steer away from that word, but that's okay.
No, we're ignoring the bad and focusing on the good.
So Willie Anderson played at a time where, again, all pros, right? Willie Anderson played at a time where it was just left tackles. People just listed tackles, and you got multiple left tackles because those are the only ones people knew, and right tackle got ignored, even though you could be the best right tackle in the NFL for a decade, and nobody had any freaking idea because all the left tackles just got the all-pro votes. That's where they went, right? Now, that's been fixed in recent years, but that was certainly an issue at the time. Like, guard, all-pros and Pro Bowls for offensive linemen, the further you go back, the iffier it gets. Now, what's interesting about Evans is he was drafted in 2006, so we actually have his whole career. And for the first 4 years, he was on a Zach Martin, Quentin Nelson kind of track. He started off with an 86.5 overall grade, 88.5, 90.2, 92.6. So we're getting better every year from an already insane starting point. And then we fell off a cliff and we went to 75 or 74, 76, 77, 79, 70, 70, 69, 70. Like, the last, 8 years of his career are a completely different level to the first four. It's a reasonable point that you give him credit for longevity versus guys like Carl Nix or Evan Mathis or whoever. But when the level of longevity is at a dramatically lower level than what we first saw or what was evident as his potential ceiling, I think that impacts significantly. So I think it's a reasonable argument to say that Jari Evans, Evan Mathis, Carl Nix, Logan Mankins probably all enjoyed a similar peak in terms of 90-plus PFF grades for about 4 years, that kind of thing. The question is, what do you do with the other years? And in, you know, Evan Mathis's case, that's the guy didn't get the opportunity to play much more than that. In Evan's case, it's, well, we got, what, eight more years of a lot less good than that, you know.
The case for... We're really getting into this. The case for Jari Evans, though, would be similar to the case for Tony Boselli. Tony Boselli was drafted in 1995, the second overall pick that year, right, for the Jacksonville Jaguars, left tackle, and he played from 95 to 01. That's it. He goes 02, he gets signed by the Houston Texans in the expansion draft and doesn't play. So for 6 years, 7 years, 95 to 01, Boselli, and he didn't even play in 01, I don't think. And he was essentially thought of as like Jonathan Ogden and, you know, all of the best left tackles. So even if you just like assume, if we had grading back there, that he was an 88 to 92 like Jari Evans, it's only like a couple of more years of elite play. And then it stopped. due to injury, whereas Evans was still an above-average player after that. So there's still – there's value in having 8 years of good after 4 years of elite.
There is.
Whereas other elite players – I mean, Kurt Warner's career is basically 4 or 5 elite years sprinkled amongst
other stuff. I think it's a very difficult question about what do you do with guys whose peak was amazing but was relatively short and then the rest of their career. And the rest of their career can be – completely different things. It can be very short because, you know, injuries or whatever, or it can be much longer but was not anywhere near the same peak. So Carl Nix had a 6-year career, but every single season was better than the other years of Jari Evans' career. You know what I mean? So the first 4 years of Evans was right up there with anything Nix did, but then every year after that was lower than the worst season we saw from Carl Nix. Evan Mathis has 7 years of 90-plus PFF grades. But one of those, you know, it was 110 snaps, like 6 years. And one of those, he was splitting reps with... who was he splitting reps with? Guy's name's falling out of my head. The
Who's
Bengals
that?
Guy. The Bengals guy that was splitting reps with
Bowling?
No, with... I'll forget. Anyway, I'll come back to that. Anyway, point is, let's call it 5.5 years of elite grading. Like, you know, I don't know what you do. I don't know how you value that correctly. 5.5 years of elite and then basically nothing versus, well, we get 4 years of elite, but then 8 more years of, like, you know, good, not great. I don't know what the correct weighting for that is.
Yeah. As far as offensive line metrics go, I get accepting all pros, although you and I have pushed back a little bit on who the voters are and the idea that before you had any sort of evaluation on the offensive line, it really was who was the guy last year.
Yeah.
That's how the Pro Bowl voting went. If you made a reputation for yourself as a guard by year two,
yes,
you could have been a Pro Bowler from years 3 through 10, no matter how you played, and an All-Pro, whether deserved or not. I mean, most of the time it's deserved, but sometimes it's reputation.
Yeah, Davin Joseph is a 2-time Pro Bowler. I don't think Davin Joseph was necessarily even a starting caliber guard for his entire career, but he was a first-round draft pick, so that stayed with him until they cut him.
And just to explain Pro Football References AV, it's essentially, did you play, right? Did you play 16 games? That's good. You were on the field. And was your offense good? And Jari Evans playing with the Saints and Drew Brees, right? You had a good offense. Therefore, him and every guard and tackle that played football while Drew Brees was the quarterback for the Saints probably had a high AV.
Yeah.
Whereas whoever played all the snaps for Chad Pennington had lower AV or whatever it is.
Nate Livings was the guard that Evan Mathis was splitting time with. Anyway, the other thing I would make, the other point about the All-Pro stuff is that the further back in time you go, the sketchier it is in terms of how accurate or not it is. I think there's a connection between PFF showing up and PFF's growth and expansion into the zeitgeist of football and how accurate those things are. You know what I mean? Like, you go back, you don't have to go back that far between, you know, player X signs. The only thing you're going to hear about him is started 16 games for a team last year. Now, people will tell you a little bit about those. You know, the knowledge about offensive line has expanded. And I'm not saying this, but offensive linemen have said this, like Andrew Whitworth has said, you guys have done a ton to increase the, you know, awareness and the knowledge of our positions and all that kind of stuff. So when you get into the Jari Evans and the Carl Nix and those guys of that mid-2000s era, that's when, like, PFF existed, but our influence was way, way lower than it was now, and I think there's a disconnect there.
Even though best ball mania has ended, Underdog Fantasy is still the easiest and most fun way to spice up your football season with their pick'em game. You just look at your favorite or least favorite player stats, pick whether you think they'll end up with a higher or lower total than the number in this week's game, and you can win up to 20 times your money in a single night. Underdog keeps it super simple with their easy-to-use website and mobile apps. This is a fun game. Pick between 2 and 5 players for your pick'em entry, get all your picks right, and you'll take home some cold hard cash. That's all it is. Just make your picks. It's simple to get started. Just head to underdogfantasy.com or download the app. Sign up with promo code PFF, and Underdog will double your first deposit up to $100. That's Underdog Fantasy. Promo code is PFF. Get in on the action today. All right, we got another email here.
Mm-hmm.
This is the Mountain Time one.
Yes, this will be a quick one, I believe, from Dustin Mazur. I believe.
Do you want to read this one?
Mazur is his name. Yeah, I'll read it because there's no y'all.
There's no y'all. So you're okay. Okay, you're the email reader.
Uh-huh. Steve and Sam, good morning to you both. it's afternoon here, but we'll let it slide. Although I come here mainly for Steve's baseball references, I do appreciate your podcast in terms of football knowledge and keeping me awake through my Mountain Standard Time night shifts where absolutely nothing is going on. Good God, that
is
must
he
be.
Following? Have we said out loud how much we hate Mountain Time? I can't remember if that's just you and I on the side, or if we have brought that to the table for our podcast listeners as well. Is he?
I don't know.
I don't know if he's playing off that, but
I don't know. Oh, yeah. I empathize with a man having, having to suffer through a Mountain Time night shift.
It's by far the worst time zone.
Yes, unequivocally. That being said, this is him, not me. I think it's safe to say that after 2 weeks, we have ourselves a case of ginger hot potato at quarterback, with Carson Wentz getting full shot at being the Lone Ranger week one, and now Cooper Rush joining the mix and taking the redheaded spotlight from Wentz. I'm curious, can the same rule apply to the Watt brothers? Week one saw TJ dominate the Bengals, and then with JJ sidelined in Arizona, and then week two, JJ comes back and leads the Cardinals to a victory with TJ sidelined in Pittsburgh. Could Derek untap his true Watt potential if both Watts go down?
The ginger theory, 5-6 years later, still going.
It's beautiful. For anyone that doesn't know, you know, who's only been listening for like a recent
time. We always have to
remind
people, yes.
The ginger theory was the theory that there's only so much ginger talent in I guess, football, the world. And generally speaking, it gets captured by one individual at a given moment. And that individual plays like superstar, and every other ginger plays like crap at the same time.
And it was really incredible. Like Carson Palmer had his run, and Andy Dalton had his run. Yeah. And then they never had their runs at the same time and the whole thing. And this year, it's kind of like Carson Wentz had a good week one.
Well, certainly based off his situational evidence that I'm not going to look beyond, it tallies. It's perfect.
It all adds up. Yeah. And then all of a sudden, Cooper Rush gets the start in weeks two and three. Washington hasn't won since then, and Cooper Rush is 2-0.
Oh, they're about to play, right? Isn't it Washington-Dallas?
Oh, I mean, the hot potato. I mean, where's it going to go?
Oh, which guy gets it?
Knowing the way Cooper Rush plays, it's probably going to be like Carson Wentz in the first half, Cooper Rush in the second half.
Within the game?
Cooper Rush has led a game-winning drive in 100% of his career starts.
Swings of ginger momentum within the game.
It's best game of the week.
Wow.
Has to be. So now the question is, can the Watts essentially?
Yeah, essentially.
Have success at the same time.
I'm particularly intrigued by that last part. If both there aren't three of them, but if both the real Watts go down, does Derek Watt become a superstar?
The real Watts.
Yeah.
If the two that we know who are good.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yes, I think he does. I'm in. I think this is true. Like as TJ has become an All Pro.
Do you think those
JJ
guys
has been banged up?
Yeah. Do you think those guys that are like the third brother? Do they just get bummed out through life constantly? You know, Derek
Cooper
Watt.
Manning is bummed out.
No, well, they're the work.
He built an Archie.
The work that the Mannings are doing right now to get Cooper a late bag in terms of commercial revenue is outstanding.
That's what I'm saying,
that man's
fine.
Presenting a game show. He's on the Caesars commercials. I saw him interviewing Dana White the other day. Like Omaha Productions is going to work for Cooper recently.
He was too busy using his genes to create Archie.
It's true.
And then you've got
Cooper Manning is
the
forgotten Manning. That's true. You have Derek Watt. You've got the third Hemsworth brother. You got Chris and Luke, who are like the leading men, the superstars. They're like 6'3", you know, Thor and whatever the hell Liam's done. And then you've got the other guy that's like 5'9" and doesn't look the same.
What about the Gronkowskis? It's just just Rob.
It's just Rob and then the other ones. Yeah. Dan and whoever that Chris.
Chris, Dan. But Dan and Chris had jobs for a while with Rob.
Had jobs for a while.
That's what like they were like, hey, I'm the fourth string tight end. I'm the backup fullback.
Yeah.
You know, they had jobs for a while.
Most of them also are the same like size and shape, you know? Like they're all like physically huge human beings. Chris is less so, right? Chris is the smaller one.
I don't know.
But like Dan Gronkowski is a huge person.
So I say yes. Derek Watt is going to become the greatest fullback. He's a fullback, right? He's going to become the greatest fullback in the league.
Would you even notice, like, if JJ and TJ go down and Derek Watt becomes the greatest fullback of all time, would anyone even notice anymore?
Well, yeah, because you have like Kyle Juszczyk the other night working back shoulders along the sideline.
Yeah,
he would have
like,
to exceed that. So Derek would have to start, you know, catching back shoulder fades and all that stuff.
Yeah, but he plays for Pittsburgh. They're not giving him those shots.
When Kenny Pickett comes in.
Oh, okay.
Kenny's going to come in.
I see.
And Kenny Pickett,
unleashed,
because we know Mitchell can't do this, but Kenny Pickett's going to get the most out of all the talent around him, which includes Derek Watt.
All right. I see.
Thanks, Dustin. Missouri. It says at the bottom.
It does. It does.
Yeah.
It says it.
You could have gotten that at the beginning.
Yeah. All right. This next one is from Aaron. Ooh, that's tough.
Let me ask it because I don't have an answer. Do you have an answer?
To the question?
Yeah.
Well, I don't have an answer to what this man's surname is pronounced yet.
Lyle?
Okay. Let's go with that.
Aaron Lyle.
All right. It's fine. Let's do that.
Here's a simple question. What happened to Kenny Golladay?
Well, that was my question. Well, that's true. Okay. Simple question.
He went from being a top alpha receiver to the highest paid bench warmer in the league. Is it injury, bad quarterback play, bad scheme fit? And he's just like, yeah, I hope he gets better.
Yeah.
Love the show. Appreciate all your data-driven analysis.
Kenny Golladay has 22 yards so far this season. He's been paid a lot of money.
Yeah.
His guaranteed money is something like $14.5 million this year. No, $17.5 million this year. He right now has generated, $140,000 for every yard he's gained, which shakes out to about $4,000 for every inch he's moved the ball forward this season.
We're only 3 weeks in. That's got to get better.
Will it? I mean, I said to you during the game,
this is Chase Daniel,
this is
while
he was dropping a ball on Monday Night Football. I was like, if you give me $1 million in like a month to get you know, into shape, I would generate more yardage this season than Kenny Golladay will.
Stop.
I'm just saying. I can get a schemed up holding the zone play. One. All I need is one. I got more than his 22 yards.
Dude, you would not.
Well, I mean, it was, yes.
I get what you're saying.
I said a month to get into shape. We're not talking now, like fresh off the couch. I got to shake off those broken hips and stuff.
So there's like the football sense in me is like, look, what made Kenny Golladay special? He was paired up with Matthew Stafford. Not that that was the thing that made him special, but Golladay has never been a guy who separates great. You know, he's a spectacular catch guy. And you need a quarterback that's going to give you spectacular catch opportunities. And Stafford did give him those opportunities. He threw it up. Golladay went up and made these incredible plays. I'm not saying that was all he did, but that was a big chunk of his game, right? And I'm not saying Daniel Jones will never give him those opportunities or whatever it might be. But that's like as a starting point. The football sense in me is like, okay, that's one of the things. But that should lead to like a little bit of a downturn in production. It shouldn't lead to Kenny Golladay being the number four receiver on a team that needs receivers. That's inexplicable right now, other than injuries and some of the other stuff. But it just, to me, it looks like Golladay just has no confidence. Because when he does actually get a pass, he's dropping it or whatever it is.
I mean, that's not helping. So last year, his first with the Giants, he dealt with a hamstring injury, he dealt with rib injury, he dealt with a knee injury. I think it's a reasonable thing to say that last season, we probably never saw a 100% version of Kenny Golladay. This season, though, like when you turn on the tape, because obviously you can't, you know, let's watch his catches. Okay, that's not going to take very long. So you actually need to watch the routes that he's running and in preseason as well. He just doesn't look. He doesn't look like an NFL athlete right now. He's like jogging through these routes and stuff. And I don't know if he is jogging through these routes. You know what I mean? It just looks that way from the tape. He just doesn't look like a wide receiver, an NFL caliber wide receiver athlete right now. He does not look like that human being. And I don't know if that's a result of the injuries he's been dealing with or if that is being done with this, you know, lackadaisical. I'm just like, I got my money. I'm no longer interested in the outcome of all this. I'm mailing it in out here. I don't know what that is. But when you turn on the tape, this is not a case of a guy where you're like, I mean, he's doing fine. He looks the same as ever. He's just not getting, you know, that's not happening. Like, whatever is happening is a physical thing as well as just being mentally not there.
I don't have any evidence to back this up, but
outstanding.
Which is a great starting point.
Yeah.
But doesn't it feel like receiver versus other positions, guys either can lose it quicker. I'm not saying Golladay has. It's not like he's old. They lose it quicker. They hit a wall, right? Like, there was a point, like, Andre Johnson randomly hit a point in his career where he just wasn't that good anymore. And Reggie Wayne hit a point in his career. We just couldn't do much anymore. Like, all these guys just hit a point where they can't do anything anymore other than Jerry Rice and yes. Larry Fitzgerald. So they all hit this point. I'm not saying Golladay's there yet, but it's this position is a little different when it comes to that. Randy Moss just hit a point where he just wasn't good anymore. And it's like, is it half a step? Is it just a little bit of explosion? Whereas other positions, it doesn't feel like there's like a wall that it just hits. There's also receivers like the Travis Fulgham thing a couple years ago.
Yeah.
How do you go from a few years of practice squad, and then it's like, okay, this is a great story. Now he's wide receiver one with the Eagles for about 6 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And then he's just practice squad guy again. So why, like, to me, it feels like receiver goes through these ebbs and flows of performance more than other positions. That's where I don't have the evidence to confirm that.
So I would take the same circumstantial evidence slash, you know, case studies and make a different argument out of them. I think that as much as we talk about what wide receivers can do to an offense, you know, when you add Tyreek Hill, what does that do to your offense? It makes the quarterback better. It makes everything around him better, all those kinds of things. I think there is also a real ability these days for offenses and quarterbacks to effectively manufacture wide receivers. So did Travis Fulgham change? Or did he just go through a four-week stretch where his team had nobody else and decided, you know what, we're going to heave the ball to Travis Fulgham for 4 weeks and see what happens? And if you just start feeding a dude that amount of targets for 4 weeks, you can get a run where he ends up with, you know, 300 yards and looks great.
Would that happen with Scotty Miller? It did, actually. I mean, he did have a stretch.
So
where he did.
You look at Kenny Galladay's career, and you sort of say, well, what is there there, right? There's 2 years where he has 1,000 yards. There's 1 year where he has double-digit touchdowns. There's 1 year, in fact, where he has more than 5 touchdowns. And in those years, like 2019, 41 of his 113 targets were contested. That's a lot. 30 of his 115 targets the year before were contested. And he was catching 57% of those contested targets. So I would essentially ask the question of, was Kenny Galladay ever good?
Oh, gosh.
Or did Matthew Stafford simply, for a 2-year stretch, throw the man 127 passes and he caught 65% of them, the contested ones? And all of a sudden we're like, oh, this guy's insane. He's incredible. But that essentially is an unsustainable thing. Or if the quarterback just determines, either that quarterback leaves or your quarterback decides, you know what, I have better options out here, I'm going to go somewhere else with the ball, you're not actually winning in the ways that wide receivers win, so your production drives off a cliff.
I do think there's a basketball, not baseball, analogy there too, okay, where there are players who are third and fourth options, and when, you know, the top options go down, they just get fed more, and all of a sudden they're 20-point score. They go from 10 points to 20 to 22.
You can manufacture a degree of production
over a stretch, right? Over a stretch of time. So maybe that's what it is with receiver.
Like, do you remember Miles Austin had a couple of years where he randomly went crazy?
I thought he was really good, though. I thought he was just really good. But Miles Austin was a pretty slick route runner.
But it was all like holes in the zone. It was like when Austin Hooper had his crazy year. And you're like, you know what? There's nothing here that happens independent of a space in the zone of a defense. Therefore, Austin Hooper is not actually good.
Yeah.
And that has been borne out since Austin Hooper has gone to a different offense. And he can no longer do that. You know what I mean? I think there is a huge degree to which receiving production for certain players is entirely predicated off simply the quarterback being willing to give him an opportunity to make a play.
So what do you do with Galladay going forward?
I mean, guy,
Brad Spielberger talking about a unique contract, a ton of money, difficult to flip.
I don't think they can get rid of him trade-wise. I don't know who's going to want that contract.
There's also, it's a new regime who's not tied to him. They didn't make the investment. So they're not out there trying to justify how much money he's making. They're just like, oh, we didn't pay him.
I think they're going
to
get...
So you don't have to, like, try to squeeze him into the offense right now.
I think they're going to get rid of him at the point where it makes the most financial sense, essentially, as soon as that is humanly possible.
No House Advantage is changing the game by offering the most dynamic fantasy sports platform available today. Play in pick'em contests versus other people for the shot at winning $250,000 plus in cash. Download the app, choose a contest, select your player props, earn points for correct picks, and climb the leaderboard for your shot to win big money every single day. You can also test your skills versus the house and 20 times your entry if you hit all your picks. Bet on up to 5 player prop over-unders or individual player matchups across every major sports league, including NFL, NBA, MLB, PGA, MMA, and NASCAR. Sign up now with the promo code PFFNFL at nohouseadvantage.com or download the app on the App Store to get a first deposit match up to $25. Make sure to check out No House Advantage today and experience daily fantasy sports redefined, because it's not just how you play, but also where you play. You don't want to miss out on this. Do you think Judge is going to get his 61 homers? He's running out of time.
How many more games he got left?
Oh, I think four or five.
Oh, then yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yankees schedule. They end in August, like first week of October. It's kind of an old school schedule. They used to cut it shorter. Yeah, they've got this is good. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 games, 8 games then left. Yeah, easy. They're going until next Wednesday? What is going on here?
Easy.
Oh, because they started the season late because they had that lockout thing or whatever.
Yeah.
He's pressing, though.
Sure. You want the next email?
Yeah, let's do it.
This one is from Riccardo Zuppelli, who I believe we've mentioned before in the podcast. Hello, sirs. I recall that in the early years of PFF, you used to refer to running back Thomas Jones as an offensive line calibration tool to do his due to his consistency at getting exactly what was blocked and no more. Is Kirk Cousins less a quarterback and more of an offensive system or roster calibration tool? Seems like the results suggest yes, especially since he's so considerate to the system as to not provide any of those pesky intangibles with which might muck up the results. As such, the Cousins cutoff seems like a decent and alliterative replacement for the Ryan inflection point. Thanks, and keep up the lengthy work.
Oh, man.
So essentially, is Kirk Cousins the new Matt Ryan inflection point line?
We got a lot of preseason pushback from the Cousins people. There's a lot of Cousins people.
The Cousins people?
Yeah, there's a lot of Cousins people. He's graded pretty well for us.
Yes.
The last couple of years. I think that's where I don't think he's the new Matt Ryan inflection point.
You don't?
No. I felt better. People forget how good Matt Ryan was.
Yeah.
Matt Ryan was really good.
Uh-huh.
He was really, really good. I think Matt Ryan's best is better than Kirk Cousins' best.
Yeah, but that wasn't the point of the Matt Ryan inflection point. Like, if you could get MVP Matt Ryan, obviously that's better than the Matt Ryan inflection point. The sort of baseline of where he is right in that zone where...
Matt Ryan was QB8, right?
Yeah.
Is what we kept saying. Uh-huh. He's QB8.
You know where Kirk Cousins ranks right now?
The season 8th, yeah, that's...
It's 9th, actually, but...
Yeah, but yeah, I get it. And he was a little bit higher last year. I don't think when you're saying we're starting a franchise right now, I don't know if Cousins makes it into the top 8. Does he?
All right, well, how many? Name them.
So starting a franchise would theoretically take out Brady and Rodgers, but let's say you're starting a one-year franchise, right? So you're not talking...
Okay.
So you're talking about winning this year.
Yeah. So you want...
So you've got Josh Allen.
Josh Allen, Mahomes.
Patrick Mahomes, Lamar Jackson, Lamar. Tom Brady, Aaron Rodgers.
Yeah. It's 5. Herbert.
Herbert, Joe Burrow. And who am I missing here?
See? You kind of run out.
No, you're not running out.
Well, who's your 8th? Because this is it. This is your number.
Sorry, I got my stats.
You got one more. Otherwise, Kirk's your guy.
Stafford.
Stafford over Kirk.
Yes.
Okay. Even though, like, you rewind a year, you probably don't say that.
And then probably Russell Wilson still.
Russ.
Yeah.
To present-day Russ over Kirk Cousins.
The evidence is mounting against that.
Yes.
But I would say Russell Wilson has a better track record that you would pay for.
Wow.
Above him. And then...
At the very minimum...
Kyler
though,
Murray.
At the very minimum, I think we can... I think that exercise illustrates he's pretty close to that line.
And Dak. Don't forget Dak. I would take Dak over Cousins.
I mean, Dak and Cousins.
And I would take Kyler.
Anyway, the point being, he is pretty much where that line should be.
He's close. I think Dak might be the better Matt Ryan inflection point.
Dak might be the better Matt Ryan. Okay.
No, I know, like, all the bike. Dak was terrible against the Bucs, and Cooper Rush is 2-0 since then, and there's controversy in Dallas and the whole thing. I get it.
I mean, I think Dak and Cousins are both good proxies for this idea of you are affected. They're good players to term like offensive system calibration tools. Like Dak, I think, is the most susceptible quarterback in the league to changes in his quarterback environment, which is exactly what that is. And Cousins, I think, because of his limitations, is a similar type of player. So I actually think they're very good examples of that. They're better than the, you know, I think. The problem with the running back, the Thomas Jones thing, being an offensive line calibration tool, is that an offensive line calibration tool at running back is not a good player at all. He will get, you know, he's a very average type of player. Whereas I think a quarterback calibration tool requires a level of play that's a bit higher than that. Otherwise, you're getting nothing.
Yeah, we're describing two different things. We use the Matt Ryan inflection point as like, this is the bottom of the top two tiers of quarterbacks that you can... You know, just increase your chances of winning. Not that a Nick Foles could never go on a run or a Flacco could never go on a run, but this was like the bottom of the top tiers, mm-hmm. right? Whereas Thomas Jones, you were basically saying this is your 3.5 yards per carry guy. And that will become 4 with a great offensive line, and it'll become 3.2 with a bad offensive line, right? That's a different – we always joke that Thomas Jones was like dead smack average quarterback. His proxy is probably closer to like Andy Dalton 6 or 7 years ago when Andy Dalton was like, he's QB 15.
Yeah.
Some years he'll be 10, some years he'll be 20, but he is QB 15, right?
Who's that guy now?
Who's QB 15?
Hmm.
By the way, Tannehill's probably right in the mix with Kirk Cousins.
Ooh, I don't know about that.
You don't think so?
I was about to suggest Tannehill for the QB 15 guy.
He might be QB 15.
Is it Jameis? Wentz?
I don't even think Jameis is that high.
Anyway, do you want to get into our next segment?
Yeah, what's our next
segment? It's your favorite. It's Explain the Grade.
All right, let's
do it. People like this. We're going to keep it going. Every week on Wednesday show, we are going to explain a PFF grade from the week previously that doesn't necessarily jive with what people thought happened or what people expect or those kinds of things. So last week we did two. I actually like the idea of doing two each week, and I'm going to stick with that this time until somebody tells me different. So, first grade, Joshua Allen, Buffalo Bills superstar, carried the team on his back, put up a ton of yards. How many yards did he put up?
He had 400 passing yards.
400 passing yards. Yeah, there we go. Put up 400 passing yards, had 2 touchdowns, but he had a PFF grade of 53.8. Why, Steve?
Well, for Josh Allen, it's pretty easy. It was all the turnover-worthy plays. It was all the plays.
How many?
6.
Yeah.
3 fumbles in there, right? Was it 3 fumbles or 2? But because there was one that we were trying to figure out how bad is it, like when we were going through the grading. Because there's one, there's like a, it's a 0 blitz, and Allen, his left tackle gets absolutely whooped. But Allen starts drifting toward the left tackle to try to create some space. But he actually made the pressure allowed by the tackle look even worse because he drifted into it and fumbles. Had another fumble in there. So I don't remember if they lost him or not because, again, when I'm looking at player evaluation, I know Allen didn't recover him. When I'm looking at player evaluation, I'm not saying, well, Bill's got it back, therefore it's not bad, right? We're saying the fumble is the fumble. We also have... He straight up missed the final throw. That's a downgrade. But the big downgrades that I'm talking about here, the turnover-worthy plays, dropped pass in the end zone by Xavien Howard. That should have been pretty much a game-ending interception. He had another drop by Javon Holland. So there are just multiple plays that were thrown into coverage that did not.
Took a shot at a cover two hole shot, but ended up being so lofted that it was essentially into triple coverage. The safety, the corner, and the slot, whoever that was, the slot corner, all converged on this throw. One of them should have picked it off.
So that was 6 total turnover-worthy plays.
Yes.
Had a few big-time throws in there. He did well. I would say the other thing, when you look at the box score, there is a difference. Like when you say a guy threw 400 yards, there's a difference throwing 400 yards on 63 attempts versus, say, 40 attempts, obviously. So... that's part of the reason why he threw for 400 yards. Yardage totals in a vacuum don't really tell you anything. Even if you were using yards per attempt as a proxy, he was at 6.3. That's a below average number. So even if you were just using a stat to say, is this 400 yards impressive? Well, not really on 63 attempts. That's a below average number. So you can't say, well, he had 400 yards. Now, if you want to go back and say, it was all him. It was like the Josh Allen show. He did lead the team with 47 rushing yards, and of course he dropped back a million times. That's context, right? To me, that's more context. And I would say the guy graded at 55 or whatever it was, 53, in a game in which the Bills put everything on his plate. And I think that's a simple explanation, the turnover-worthy plays.
And he gets credit for 4 big-time throws in that game. So this was one of the most wild performances you're going to see in terms of a ton of big-time throws and a ton of turnover-worthy plays as well. It was right there with that Mac Jones game this week.
Right.
There was a lot of good in there, but there was also a lot of bad.
We get a lot of questions about turnover-worthy. So the Patrick Mahomes last interception, someone almost immediately after that happened sent us a message. Hey, is that turnover worthy? So the last interception, it's the last play of the game. He throws a slant. I think it was on 4th down, 3rd down, whatever it was. Throws a slant. It gets tipped.
twice, and then, right?
Maybe a couple times, and then eventually intercepted. That was not turnover worthy because you throw the slant, it's just a regular pass breakup. That thing falls to the ground literally 97, 98% of the time.
Yeah.
Right? So that's what we're judging it. Did you throw a pass that was... Now, if he threw it behind the receiver,
right,
at the defensive back, we'd say, yeah, that's turnover worthy. You threw it at him, right? So there are levels to these things, but we also just look at, like, a batted pass falls to the ground the majority of the time just because it becomes an interception, not turnover worthy in our sense. The Mahomes one, same thing. So the turnover worthy plays will get a much lower grade in our system.
So on the flip side, we have a quarterback who put up, you know, reasonable numbers, but who had a PFF grade of 92.5 this week, and that is Browns' new starting quarterback due to suspension, Jacoby Brissett. So Jacoby Brissett went 21 of 31 for 220 yards, two touchdowns, and zero interceptions, but had a PFF grade of 92.5. Why?
So a couple reasons here with Brissett. First off, he played a really good game. I mean, this wasn't the difference in this versus the Allen game, when you're watching Josh Allen, there's enough good plays in there where you're like, man, this dude's like, he's balling out, he's doing these things, and it's easy to kind of ignore the bad ones. With Brissett, you're watching this game against the Steelers being like, he's playing a really good game. Now, you probably didn't come out of that thinking, it's a 92. That's a very good game.
I do think there's definitely a group of people that are sort of saying, hey, how does Jacoby Brissett get a 90 grade? Who didn't watch Jacoby play in that game. You know what I mean? Because Jacoby Brissett played very well in that game. And even if you didn't have, you know, the grade, even if you weren't writing anything down, even if you just watched the game, you'd come away impressed with how Jacoby Brissett played on Thursday night.
Where's the stat line again?
21 of 31 for 220 yards, two touchdowns, and no picks.
So I want to talk differently about this one, because to me this was Jacoby Brissett threw 10 incompletions. And if you watched his game against the Jets in week two, he was not making any mistakes until he made a terrible mistake at the end of the game. Brissett was not missing throws. So I think what happens with quarterback stats versus the grades, not every incompletion is on the quarterback. Mm-hmm. And it's not just drops, right? So of those 10 incompletions, we have a couple drops. Those are pretty clear. Those are easy to explain. We also have one that we didn't necessarily call a drop, because we have different types of incompletions. Amari Cooper, it was 4th and 2. He's wide open. Jacoby hits him, kind of loses it on the way to the ground. Doesn't necessarily go to the drop total, but it's essentially a drop, right? So Jacoby's incompletions were a combination of a couple drops, a couple times when he got hit while throwing, a miscommunication in there, which we don't necessarily, you know, dock anybody, a couple pass breakups. That's better. That's good defense more than bad offense. And one where Amari ran out of bounds.
Yeah, that's
right.
The one I
know
talk about.
You saw this one, and again, he only threw for 220 yards, but these things start to add up. It's essentially like a 25 for 31. Like if you just gave him a couple of these completions that he earned, all of a sudden he's like 25 for 31 for 300, and the stat line matches the 92 grade a lot better.
That one play, I think, is an important one, because that play, because of Amari Cooper running out of bounds. You know how that's recorded in the game book, the stat line? Goes down as an incompletion. Even though it landed in his hands, the receiver caught it, and he ran for 50 yards, right? Because he stepped out of bounds, it doesn't even get nullified. It actually counts as an incomplete pass on the play and a loss of down. So if you give him that play, and this is a play, it wasn't just, hey, wide the hell open Amari Cooper, a pass, whatever. Jacoby Brissett escapes pressure in the pocket, rolls out to the right, waits for Cooper to get open, hits him with a pass. And at the point he attempted the pass, Cooper hadn't stepped out of bounds yet, right? So at the point where Brissett's part of the play is finished, he has loosed the ball to an open receiver who's about to get a big gain off the back of it, having manufactured that play himself by getting out of a cluttered pocket and finding space to make that happen. So this is a play where Brissett absolutely should get real credit for it. The play went for, I think, 50 yards, 53, something like that. If you give him that catch back and say, you know, what happened after that with Cooper running out of bounds is not his fault, so let's count that as a play, it gives him 278 yards instead of 220 yards. It gives him a passer rating of 120 instead of 109. You know, and all of a sudden we're feeling a lot better immediately about 91 versus that kind of box score performance. So that, I think, is a really good example of how, like, one play through something completely independent of you can very well alter like the difference in the box score numbers versus the grade.
Yeah, that's I like to use the stats just to paint the picture, because I push back on that a lot of times. I say don't look at the stats; they paint a picture that does that isn't always there. But I like to say, all right, if you're going to use the stats as a baseline because they speak to you, give them these three plays. And give them these three plays. Give them or take away these three plays that they earned, and then see what the stats look
and
like.
And I'm not saying that like that that one play itself is why Brissett earned a 90, right? Because there was yards after the catch on that play as well. It's not like it was this, you know, it wasn't an incredible sort of 55-yard bomb that was into tight double coverage or whatever. It was a nice play by Jacoby Brissett. But it, with the point being, it affected his box score a lot, and it was one of a number of plays in this game that didn't go his way when they should have. And when you look at the grading, like he got downgraded like once in that game or something. He basically didn't make a mistake.
Second straight week, he just was not making mistakes. So this
and
was
unlike
game,
the last one, he didn't then go and torpedo it with one like head slapping mistake late on.
Jacoby also did a really good job moving the chains with QB sneaks and things that affected his rushing grade, so that all helped out as well. So again, I think having a one number grade is great and all, but there's a lot of ways that you can get there, right? 90s, sometimes 90s are because guys get have a ton of big time throws, but other times it's they just don't miss a whole lot. They're not the reason for incompletions or bad plays, and that's kind of been Jacoby's good grades the last 2 weeks. He's just not missing a whole lot. He is not overthrowing, underthrowing, throwing uncatchable passes to his receivers.
By the way, if you gave him that that extra pass we're talking about, he would have ended up with a much better yards per attempt figure. He would have been right under 9. So he would go from 7.1.
And the stats would have matched up perfectly.
So it's just another way that box score would have... if you give him that box score instead of the one he actually ended up with, there wouldn't be that many people arguing, well, that doesn't feel like a 90 grade.
And I just want to say, I think the grades, they're not perfect as far as separating from your supporting cast, but I think they're better than even the most advanced metrics like EPA, which I always try to reference is more of a team-driven stat, right? When your quarterback throws a jump ball and your receiver mosses him for the play, you get all the EPA. And you get all, and then that goes into your QBR by ESPN. ESPN focuses on EPA and air yards. So when your receiver does the work 50 yards down the field to win on a jump ball, your quarterback stat is directly affected by what the receiver does. And we try to do our best to parse that out. Not perfect, but we do our best. Like a jump ball is a good example where we do a good job of saying, that's a jump ball. That's going to fall incomplete 80% of the time. We're going to give you zero credit for that. We're going to say that's a neutral score by the quarterback. And if it becomes a completion, or doesn't it become a completion, it doesn't change the quarterback results there.
Yeah, it's impossible to separate the quarterback from everything else around him. That's why we spend so much time talking about the impact of receivers, the impact of coaches, all this kind of stuff.
Right.
We attempt to do that. You can't ever separate them out. But the attempt is what... And, you know, we get criticism because of the subjectivity. Well, you're just attempting to do it by this crazy subjective, you know, which way is the wind blowing way of grading. And there's structure to it, but the attempt to separate that out is what makes PFF grading more predictive than other measures out there. Like, it's why it's been shown by other people, not by us, to have a greater predictive power than using EPA or using, you know, whatever other metric you like. It's because that attempt to separate out the quarterback from other things, even if you can't get all the way there, even if you can't even get most of the way there, like just taking a swing at that thing is important.
So there you go. It's our explain the grade session every
segment.
Wednesday.
Yeah.
Sound good?
Explained. Done.
Completely explained.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure nobody's going to... If you liked that explanation, hit the thumbs up button in the YouTube. If you think we're idiots, you can still give us a thumbs up
anyway.
Yeah.
And remember, look, if there's a particular grade you want to see every week, then hit us up. Message us on Twitter or send us an email, nflpodcast@pff.com. We are eager to explain the ones that people want to hear the most about.
So there you go. Let's go to... is that it for our part of the show here?
Yeah, now I think we're straight into Mike.
All right, let's preview a little Bengals-Dolphins.
All right, very pleased to welcome in Mike Ryan Ruiz, EP, executive producer, right, of the Le Batard Show, executive producer at Meadowlark, all kinds of, and all things Miami correspondent.
Yeah, all things Meadowlark is probably a good way. I know I have a pretty ambiguous title, so that's a, he laid it out, those part of the Le Batard Show and doing some stuff with Meadowlark. Big fans of you guys and your site, always fun to have you guys on the show, so... When I got the offer, I couldn't help but reciprocate. Thank you so much. Very honored to be here.
Very happy to have you. The first thing I want to start with, this is one that Steve wants no part of, but you're a Chelsea fan, you know, for the Premier League, the people that listen. I'm a Liverpool fan. So I'm curious, in your opinion, which one of us is more screwed this season?
We're both pretty screwed. At least with Chelsea, they have a history, even with a new owner, of being able to realize, oh, this is not going well. We should change everything, and maybe that'll give it the spark that they need. It's interesting with Liverpool, because you let go of Mane, but I actually thought that was a right move. If you're looking to get rid of a player at a stage in their career, I know he's been playing very well. Time will tell. I think Liverpool ends up making the top four. I can't say the same for Chelsea right now. It's a bit of a transitional year for them. Thankfully, they've been as aggressive with younger players like U18s, U20s in their signing strategy. So hopefully there's a good foundation being built over here, but I'm not too bullish on Chelsea right now.
It is the great thing about Chelsea, though, that you're only ever 6 to 9 months away from a total reset, which can change everything.
I'm a little disappointed that Boley handed Tuchel the reins to the transfer strategy. If this was always the plan, I'm not really sure why we're looking for players that fit his style. If the plan was to get somebody in there that you jibed with a little bit better, but onward and upward, chaos and trophies. That's the motto around Chelsea. So we got the chaos right now. Trophies tend to follow.
Is that what you were hoping for, Sam?
Yeah, well, there you go. Yeah. That's it. Well, that's all the soccer story.
It's a good, icebreaker to talk soccer. Let's get to the Dolphins. They're 3-0. First time since what, 2018?
They were 2018, right? But if you look at 2018, it was pretty fraudulent. They've beaten some impressive teams this year.
That's my question, right? Because teams have been 3-0. The Panthers were 3-0 last year, right? The Giants were just 2-0. Going into Monday, is this a legit 3-0? Are the Dolphins for real? And what's it like down there as far as the buzz go with the Dolphins?
Well, a lot of dormant social media accounts are once again at the peak of their game right now. I saw there was a Twitter account, the Hard Rock Stadium Sun, has opened up account. The Hard Rock Stadium Sun is having their victory tour. We had Stephon Diggs coincidentally on our show yesterday, and he said it's the most exhausted after a game he's ever been. You have Bills Mafia complaining on Twitter about OSHA violations because of the Sun.
That's perfect. That's great.
Which I was actually happy that there was a national spotlight on what I've been saying every time I leave my house for work. God damn, it's hot.
That temperature was crazy. Look, I mean, you live in Miami, right? So you're used to that kind of heat. But as an Irishman displaced to a foreign country, 100 degrees Fahrenheit is cruel and unusual punishment. It should not be permitted without, you know, air conditioning.
I've lived here all my life. It's getting hotter. It's irrefutably getting hotter. I know I'm getting older, maybe not as good at running with these things, but as a Canes booster, I'm at that stadium a lot for tailgates, and it's pretty inhumane to be playing a sport out there right now. But to answer your original question, while I'm not a Dolphins fan, I'm rooting for several people in that organization. I've had the privilege of meeting the head coach. I'm rooting for him. There's a good energy around town about this team. It's been so long that I barely even remember what this town was like when the Dolphins were really cooking. And right now, this seems sustainable. You mentioned 2018. They had that one Chad Pennington year where they totally took advantage of the Tom Brady injury and ran with it. This seems like the seeds of something sustainable. So I think that the excitement level here for the Miami Dolphins is at a level that I haven't seen, quite honestly, since, I'm not going to say Marino because that's cliche, but since the Fiedler, Jason Taylor, Zach Thomas, end of Jimmy Johnson, start of Juan Sat tenure
since
with Ricky Williams. I think that they think that they're in the game now, and they may be in the game for quite some time.
But that, like, the Marino threshold is the really interesting one, because even when Miami was a pretty good team and they had a good defense and Jay Fiedler was the quarterback, they were good, But there's always that feeling of, hey, we have a Jay Fiedler team going up against, you know, real quarterbacks. Whereas all of a sudden, if Tua, you know, continues to play like he is, even if it's a product of Tyreek Hill and Mike McDaniel and everything else, it's a different feeling. You know, that they're potentially real contenders versus just sort of everybody feeling waiting to get found out a little bit against the best teams.
Yeah. Yeah, I think in many ways Dan Marino was obviously a great thing to happen to the franchise, but maybe a bad thing to happen to the fan base, because it set a bar that even the Miami Heat had trouble meeting. I think I can safely say, like, Dwayne Wade is maybe at that Marino level, but it's basically this town's Michael Jordan, and every quarterback that has ever walked through the door down here is directly compared to Dan Marino. And you guys know from being in football media what a cult of personality Tua has become. When they're cooking, when they're winning games because he's making plays down the stretch, especially displaying a big arm, you're getting generations of people making that comparison, and they're finally buying in. They've had good teams, but for the fan base to really feel like they have a shot, they need the quarterback to be the face of it. They need to believe in the quarterback. And there's always been spirited debate surrounding Tua, but now you're starting to have consensus buy-in on him. It still may be too soon, but the fan base has seen enough, I think, to make a judgment call.
Yeah, it's such a fascinating thing, because quarterbacks get all the credit, all the blame, but of course you need to have a supporting cast. And the supporting cast that Miami has built, outside of the offensive line, which is coming together, they've made some investment there, and it's certainly better there. But the idea of having a Jaylen Waddle with incredible speed, you add Tyreek Hill to the mix, and then you add Mike McDaniel, who you mentioned a little bit too. It felt like McDaniel just burst onto the scene in the middle of last year. Like, the 49ers said, hey, go do press conferences all of a sudden. And before you know it, the guy's got a quote that's going viral every single week. What do you make of Mike McDaniel so far, and what he's been bringing to the table in this turnaround?
It's actually interesting. I've always liked Mike McDaniel, dating back to when I was a Browns fan, and he had to come to the sideline and act with Johnny Manziel on a gadget play. I'm a huge fan of Kyle Shanahan, dating back to Mike Shanahan. I think that offense has just had proven results. So anybody that comes out of that system, I'm always kind of bullish on. The reaction to Mike McDaniel, I'd say nationally and even locally, I'm not even sure he's that big of a fan of it, because let's say for day one of camp, the media asked him to take a selfie. You know, this is still very much a leader of men. You're not going to be asking Brian Flores to take a selfie with the group. Right. I think he's quirky when compared to other folks, but people tend to view that as a shot at one's leadership. And I think he has buy-in, and he talks to people like they're adults, but he expects results. And I was always super high on the guy. It's funny, when the Brady-Sean Payton thing happened, I had the hot take at the time that missing out on those guys isn't necessarily the worst thing, because I believed in Mike McDaniel so much. This is not me having a victory parade, because I still think it's very early in the process. The one thing that has shocked me so far in the Mike McDaniel experience is I thought you could hang your hat on the running game being better than it was last year when they had guys like Gaskin and Ahmed back there. And I mean, Gaskin, I think, is not getting any play now. He's fourth on the depth chart right now, and still the running game hasn't gotten going. That's not how Mike McDaniel wants to be winning games, yet he is still winning them. It's a sign of a good team when they're pulling victories out and they're doing it in unexpected ways. When the running game of a Kyle Shanahan protege hasn't really gotten fully online yet, I think there's plenty of reason for hope, and the Dolphins are looking to me like an almost certain playoff team.
I always think of, you know, when you're trying to decide credit or blame, I think of it as a sort of pie chart, you know, and how much of a portion of the pie does each person deserve in terms of credit or blame. So for this Miami turnaround, how much of a piece of the pie do you think belongs to Tua actually being a better quarterback once you give him players to throw to and an offensive line that can survive on its own for more than a second? How much is Mike McDaniel, and how much of it is bringing in just like an absolute freak superstar like Tyreek Hill, who is, you know, a unique athlete in the NFL?
Well, I think let's start at the top. Let's give Stephen Ross some credit, but not in the way that you would think conventionally. He wanted to win so bad that he botched this situation so poorly that now they have a head coach that is certainly going to support him way more than Flores ever did. And I think that's part of the problem. You had a quarterback that was certainly lacking confidence, and if you look at the list of play callers, if you could even identify who was calling the plays over the last few years, this was not necessarily a situation where you can make a fair evaluation, which got us so tired of the Tua conversation to begin with, because the rational wait-and-see approach doesn't make sense in today's day and age. But the Dolphins, a lot like the Philadelphia Eagles, decided to load the offensive side of the ball up with talent, have a more aggressively offensive-minded head coach, so you can make a fair evaluation and reserve some of your draft capital for the following year should you move the same way that Philadelphia did. Unfortunately, Stephen Ross got hit with a tampering charge, so that draft capital for next year is all gone. And thankfully for the Dolphins, the Tua project so far in being able to get a fair representative data point is working out, I think. We'll see. I'm not, if they lose, if they get boat race on Thursday, I wouldn't necessarily read too much into that. And we can get into the matchups a little bit later for a very good Thursday night game. But I think because they miss out on Peyton, because they miss out on Brady, they might have found something a little bit more sustainable here with Tua and Mike McDaniel.
Well, let's get into Thursday night. Let's do it, because it's our hometown. It's not our team or anything like that, but it's our hometown, Cincinnati Bengals. And the buzz was incredible here in town just a few months back. The whole city was lit up, orange and all that stuff. And we got Joe Burrow. We have our guy. But the Bengals start 0-2. They beat the Jets. They're 1-2 now. So not as much excitement as you have in Miami at the moment. But the Bengals still believe they have their guy, but Joe Burrow's still taking sacks at a ridiculous rate. So now you have Miami, who loves to blitz and has a good group of pass rushers. You know, adding guys like Trey Flowers and Melvin Ingram basically for nothing. We talked about that on Monday. It was just a great, great additions by the Dolphins. What are your thoughts on this Dolphins defense, their pass rush, and what that is going to do against this Bengals offensive line that's still trying to figure it out?
Well, to give Mike McDaniel a bit more credit, was he walked into that room and he could have just demanded a sweeping change on the defense and something that was in line with his philosophy, but the defense was pretty solid last year, especially down the stretch. He decided to keep some continuity there with the defensive coordinator. They're running a very similar system that they had success in last year. I think the world of Javon Holland. I think Xavien Howard is a player that might have his name honored in the Ring of Honor for the Miami Dolphins. A lot of what they do and how aggressive they blitz is a testament to guys like Holland and Xavien Howard, because they trust them to be on an island and make plays. We saw that kind of caught up with them maybe in the first half against Baltimore, but overall those players are absolutely flashing. As far as what it means for Thursday night, you guys know that Joe Burrow has been struggling against cover two. Dolphins run man and zero and three just about more than anybody else in the league right now. So Joe Burrow is going to have a bit of a break from the looks that have been giving him a little bit trouble. But Miami's still going to be very aggressive trying to get to the quarterback. Both of these offenses aren't nearly as efficient when under pressure. So I actually think that this is a good get-right matchup defense that Joe Burrow has in front of him. It's kind of like now or never. This is actually a huge game for the Cincinnati Bengals. Entering the season, I wasn't as high on the Bengals, because if you look at what happened last year, it caught a lot of breaks. A lot of breaks. And think about, if Aaron Donald gets to the quarterback just a split second later, they might have just straight up stolen a Super Bowl championship, when you can make the arguments that they probably shouldn't have gotten out of that Raiders game, certainly should have had no business winning that Tennessee game, and the Chiefs approached their lead in that AFC championship game with an arrogance that was almost unparalleled. So I just don't think they're as good as your typical young AFC champion would be. That's not to say that they're not going to build back. I am surprised that Mike Brown actually decided to invest in the offensive line, and yet it is no way better than it was last year. And now, is that starting to catch up to Joe Burrow? You guys are the experts. You tell me.
Yeah, I mean, so I think this is an interesting matchup because of the way that Miami plays coverage is a little bit different than everything they've been seeing. So they've been seeing teams that can get pressure, that can cause Burrow problems, but unlike last year, he can't really just sort of heave and hope to Ja'Marr Chase, because teams are playing the kind of coverages that dissuade that. The Dolphins don't, but they blitz the hell out of him. So it is this fascinating dynamic of, you know, on the one side, you're probably going to see some looks in the secondary that you quite like this weekend. The downside is what happened last week to Josh Allen, which is you're not going to have time to, you know, sit there, survey it, and decide you like that matchup, you're going to be put under pressure and, you know, have heavy blitzes coming your way early and often, and you're going to have to make those calls quickly, which is not something Burrow typically loves doing.
Right, but to your point, he still has a lot of weapons out there, but if you look at the injury report for both teams, this is a low-key mash units for both, but it's the ones that they play through. So I'm not really sure. I think for the Cincinnati Bengals, this game is coming at a right time. That was a hugely emotional win for Miami. Short turnaround. They lose time on the travel. As we highlighted, the matchup, at least in the secondary, is good for Joe Burrow. They absolutely need this one. I think you can basically write off the Bengals if they lose this one and drop to 1-3. Prime time. They got the uniforms that everybody's excited about. I'm really into this Thursday night game. I think they've gotten really lucky with the Thursday night matchup so far. They've all been kind of interesting and captivating. And for Cincinnati in particular, there is so much on the line here. If Miami strolls into the defending AFC champion and ends up losing a game that defending AFC champion absolutely has to have with what we assume is a proven commodity, I don't really think you can hold that against them too much. If they go in there and win, considering the circumstances that we just outlined right now, then you're legitimately, even though some folks locally are entertaining it after last week's win, you're legitimately talking about division and hosting a playoff game and the Buffalo Bills path, in which they're this astronomical favorite to win the AFC, now all of a sudden is a path that goes through the road. It's huge implications for the AFC on Thursday night, I think.
Wow, we're already at that. The Dolphins are already hosting playoff games here. We have gotten ahead of ourselves.
I mean, I think it's a good point that there's not much to lose from Miami's perspective in terms of if they drop this game, you know, given how much Cincinnati needs it, there's no shame in that from a Miami standpoint, but there's a lot to gain, as he points out. If you win this game, like, that's a major statement off the back of the previous three.
It is. That's the tough part, right? You talked about how physically demanding that game was on Sunday, and, like, you felt it. I mean, it felt like a heavyweight battle, which usually happens, like, in the snow in December, but you could feel the heat. Like, you could feel it. The crowd also sounded like the loudest I've ever heard. The heat didn't affect the fans, apparently.
No. That place actually does have an atmosphere when you have a good team behind it. I know that it's kind of gotten viral for the University of Miami lately and their lack of crowds. But I will tell you, in 2017, when they hosted Notre Dame, I had people that worked at ESPN and College Game Day say that's the second loudest stadium they've ever heard in their entire life because of how it's designed, how it keeps the sound in there, and how it's definitely designed for the away team to be punished by the elements over there. But that was a lot of plays that Miami's defense was out there for. 90 approximately in that neighborhood. Can they get the same kind of push? Will their pass rushers have their legs underneath them? Will guys like Xavier Howard still have enough juice in their lower bodies to keep up with this stellar skill weaponry that Joe Burrow has at his disposal in guys like Higgins and Chase and Boyd? I just think it's a bridge too far to expect Miami to win this. Certainly, they're an underdog. If they overcome all of that, and you have to take a treetop view on what their season's been so far, then I don't think it's a ridiculous conversation to have that, say, AFC East is certainly in play, and the schedule actually lays out quite nicely for Miami after having a very difficult start to it.
So we want to get a pick from all of our Thursday or Wednesday guests, and we'll get that in a second. But first, I just want to ask, are you intentionally disrespecting our guests wearing a Florida Gators top? This is a Miami Hurricanes man, and you're sitting there.
Is that what he's doing? Gators. I couldn't even tell because the screen was small. Look, we're having rough weeks, Steve and I, too, because right now FSU Twitter isn't shy about leaning into their banter advantage that they certainly have right now. Ironically enough, not preaching patience when they lost to Jacksonville State last year. But it's like that line in Batman. Why do we fall?
Pick ourselves up. We're here trying to get good guests on. We're trying to be nice to them, and you're sitting there wearing.
Look, I make my decisions because it's not 100 degrees here. It feels like fall out there,
and this is
my best fall pullover. So here I am. My best.
Just sucking up to Collinsworth right too.
This is
the boss.
That's true. Yeah, this is the first day that I've had to wear not shorts to work for months.
it's starting to feel like fall up here. So
all right, Mike. So the Dolphins are a 4-point underdog going into the cauldron that is Paul Bryant Stadium, right?
Yeah. Whatever. Paycor?
How do you think Stadium. That's Paycor Stadium? They renamed
that? Yeah, Paycor.
Oh, that was this year, right?
Yeah, Paycor.
Yeah, okay.
Get it
it's
right.
Always the jungle.
Yeah, into
you hedge all your bets and you just call it the jungle.
Into new corporate brand stadium. How do you think it's going to go? What's your pick?
I'd be really surprised if Miami wins this game outright because of all the very logical reasons why they would lose this game.
Sure.
And for me, it's a matchup, and it's a spot that the Bengals absolutely have to have. I think the emotion, the plays that they all ran, the heat from Sunday, all of it catches up to Miami. I don't think there's shame in it. It'd be a valiant effort, but without the running game fully online to lean on, I don't see Miami having enough juice on both sides of the ball to keep up with a primetime home crowd in a game that is sorely needed. So I'm going to go Bengals here. I think Bengals win this one by double digits.
Oh, wow.
By double digits. Wow. So after all that talk, because in 2018, the Dolphins were 3-0, and I think they went to New England in week four. And people were like, oh, the Dolphins, they're for real this year. And then New England waxed them, and it was like, oh, same old Patriots, same old Dolphins. I don't believe that's the case with this Dolphins team. However, when you see a line of four, I know there's the factors that you laid out very nicely, but you see a line against last year's AFC participant in the Super Bowl and all that stuff, it seems like Vegas might not believe the Dolphins are real just yet. With a 4-point spread here in this game.
Yeah, it is.
What do you think? What do you think this, Sam? What do you think this line would be if the Dolphins were at home? If you look at the balance of the season, I'm out here picking the Bengals, and I think once we get to the end of the season, I believe the Dolphins are a better team. That doesn't necessarily mean they're going to win this game. What do you make of the line here, Sam?
I'm very surprised that the line is what it is for last week as much as anything else. The first 2 weeks, Cincinnati's offensive line looking terrible and Burrow struggling because of it made a degree of sense because you were going up against two of the best pass rushers in the NFL, TJ Watt and Micah Parsons. And you can say, okay, you overhauled the offensive line, you brought in new talent. There's still nobody there that can block those guys one-on-one. Like, that's a matchup you're going to lose. The Jets didn't have anybody like that, and yet the Jets were still able to put Burrow under a lot of pressure. And okay, he played a lot better under that pressure, and we talked about that on Monday, but I think Miami can do a similar thing. Like, this is going to be an issue for Cincinnati all season long, and that, to me, kind of puts a cap on just like any degree of confidence you can have about the Bengals. Like, we saw what they were able to do to Josh Allen, and Allen's, got a better track record than Burrow has of being able to just carry everything by himself and make it all happen, and that was enough to win that game.
Do you think the offense can make enough plays down the stretch? I mean, keep in mind, Buffalo was out four players in their secondary, very good players.
You had sure.
Yeah. Two players suffering heat stroke. You had Stephon Diggs having a full body cramp by the end of it, always going to the sideline. And yet, Miami, and I know that they've had their own injuries to deal with, including one to the quarterback, who is now at the center of an investigation. But
just a back injury.
That game was won by the defense. Again, finding different ways to win. Can the offense potentially keep pace if guys like Chase and Higgins start taking advantage of things that we said, the short week in the matchup?
I think that's definitely an interesting side of this matchup. Anytime you can deploy, Tyreek Hill, Jalen Waddle, as good as the Cincinnati defense is, and I think it is sort of understated good, and Awuzie and guys like that have been playing well in the secondary. Just the idea ever of Chidobe Awuzie being one-on-one with Tyreek Hill.
No, Eli Apple being one-on-one.
Even worse.
Because Tyreek's already calling out Eli Apple.
Yeah, and Eli's hurt.
Yeah.
So he's just excited to see Eli
It feels
Apple
like there's going to be some plays there available for that Miami offense.
Oh, man, I would have taken the Bengals, and then I saw fourth feels like a lot, but I like the Bengals here.
You're going with the Bengals?
I just think it is. You see this more in college. The emotional win and the difficulty coming back-to-back and all that stuff, coming back the next week. But I think the short week and all that stuff will potentially catch up here.
All right.
For the Dolphins.
I'm gonna be the Miami stand then. I'm going to take the Dolphins with four.
If the Dolphins get through this, though, this is what we said about the Titans last year, right? They went through that stretch, and they became the number one seed at the end of the day. They went through that stretch. I forget the order, but it's like, can they get by the Chiefs and the Bills and the Rams and, like, two other teams? And they did it despite all their injuries. If the Dolphins start doing that, like, despite the odds against them, they get by this game. And like you said, Mike, they got a pretty good schedule after that. We're talking about the Dolphins, with a really good record, maybe by week 10.
Yeah.
Yeah, no doubt. Sometimes you don't bet teams, you bet spots. And I think that this lays out quite nicely for Cincinnati, which is what I'm doing there. And maybe by the end of the game, you see Miami succumb to everything that we've outlined. And maybe Cincinnati starts pulling away in that fourth quarter a little bit. It's just such a good spot for Cincinnati. If they don't, as much as we're going to be talking about Miami and what a great season they're in line to be having, huge question marks, I think, around Cincinnati. And while guys like us are talking about, yeah, they kind of got lucky last year, and maybe this is a little bit of the mean, you can make it to a Super Bowl. You're not really preaching patience to a fan base. They can't rationalize all the breaks that they got last year. Yeah. So it'll be very interesting to see how a Bengal fan base that has been devoid of hope for so long finally feels like they have something sustainable, getting a reality check like that. I'd be very curious to see how that flies.
I will say, we've only been doing this for 3 weeks in terms of getting a guest on and asking them to predict the game. But the only guest that's nailed it so far has been Joe Thomas, who predicted the Browns by a million and was very much influenced by, you know, being a Browns legend. So I'm just not sure this is the time to go away from your Miami roots. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if you know, but I'm totally workshopping the Rob Lowe fan experience this season. I've seen the Bengals once this year already. I was at that Dallas game. I have tickets, and we'll see what happens. And prayers out to the people on the west coast of Florida. I have tickets for Mahomes versus Brady on Sunday night. I'm going to be going to Sunday Night Football Halloween weekend in Buffalo for that Packers game. I really like to see the best. Now, after years of being a Browns fan and watching a lot of bad football, I'm so indulging in football hedonism and the best possible storylines, and I think we actually have a pretty damn good storyline on Thursday night.
Do you have like the that. Rob Lowe hat? Do you have you found just the shield?
Oh yeah. Oh, I.
You got it. You got the whole setup.
Yeah. Let me go grab it right now. I've got a million NFL hats.
That's
loaded it up. I mean, I have a raincoat that I was wearing yesterday that is just all 32 helmets.
This is nice. This is how we do. I mean, this is where I am. Right. We're just unbiased analysts. Well, watching the football, rooting for football. That's what we're here for.
Oh, look at this. Look at this. The Rob Lowe.
That's what we're looking for.
Perfect. Yeah. The Rob Lowe. Our PR guy, David Solfaro, found a hat that was just the AFC, which I think is even better.
Well, that's like I always push back against the college
fans. Please, hop in the DMs and tell me where to find that.
That's like the college fans. Like when people like, if you're a Pac-12 fan, you really hated this weekend. I'm like, who's out there rooting for the Pac-12? Who's out there rooting for the conference?
Well, this is like, you know, we think that the axing.
SEC
the
fans, Steve, yeah, to answer
SEC
your question.
SEC fans. Oh, no, I know.
We think axing the Pro Bowl, you know, it's a victimless crime. But there's like seven guys or hardcore AFC fans every year that are gutted that we've just nixed the Pro Bowl.
AFC, we're ready to have a run. As AFC fans.
That's our time. Yeah. Mike, thanks so much for coming on the podcast. You've been awesome.
Honored to be here again. Thank you guys so much for having me.
We'll have you back when the NFL's playing, you know?
Yeah. Oh, you can guarantee, you can take it to the bank every week the NFL's playing.
Thanks, Mike.
See ya.